If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Electric Drum here on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario here, and today I am joined by Gary Heisman, superintendent of Hamden Schools.
Right.
Gary, tell me a little bit about where you're from. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New Haven. I was born in New Haven, and we first lived in Ashman Street Projects, moved from Ashman Street Projects to Eastern Circle, better known now as Exit 8. Back then, it was Eastern Circle. And then, you know, shortly thereafter, moved to the Hill, where I lived most of my life in the Hill. And then moved out to Westville, and that's where I am now. But I spent the most important parts of my life in the Hill section of New Haven.
How was it growing up in the Hill, and who were some of the influences there?
Look, I love the Hill, right? And I still love the Hill. I loved growing up there. There were, at that time, in the 70s, there were all different ethnic groups there. I have friends across all ethnic groups and got a taste of what culture was and, you know, what respect was and what friendship was growing up in the Hill. I had a number of influences in the Hill. Some teachers I had, one of my very first teachers, my third grade teacher, Sal Punzo at Hill Central, was a tremendous influence. And ironically, later on, I would go, and when I got my first assistant principal's position, he was the principal of the school. So we've had this relationship now that's turned into a friendship based on mutual respect, at least for about 45 years. And we still see each other. We still stay in touch with each other. And Sal's still going. He still looks exactly the same all these years later. So I went to Hill Central. And then I went to Horace Day School for a year. And Horace Day is on Rosette Street. And we were there for a year while Roberto Clemente was getting built. And so I went to Roberto Clemente for my seventh grade and eighth grade year. I think we were the first class in Roberto Clemente. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. I had great teachers. I had great friends. It was an awesome time when I was 13. So my parents unfortunately divorced when I was around four or five. And, you know, it was a difficult time because I have five siblings. So it left my mother to be a single parent, raising six kids, four of us boys at the time. So that was a lot of work on her part to do that alone. And then when I was 13, my mother passed suddenly. And then, so that left my two oldest sisters, who I think were probably 21 and 19 at the time, to raise me. And they did an exceptional job being there. And, you know, nobody can take your mother's place. But they did an exceptional job of raising me. And I had such a great experience in the Hill. Either with, I spent a lot of time at the Boys Club. It was the Boys Club then. It's the Boys and Girls Club now. But I spent my really formative years at the Boys Club, night and day at that place. Had some great people who worked there, people like Steve Jenkins, people like Bob Kelleher, Willie Elder worked there, Larry Kelly worked there. I came across so many, Felicia Shishinka worked there. I came across so many great people who worked there, who sort of filled in for me and created community. I had neighbors who were also there for me, turned into my parents as well. But there were a few people in particular, I think, aside from my teachers and those people I just named, like Jay Reed, for example, was a coach of Hill All-Stars. And Jay is still, he's still my man to this day because of everything he meant to me and the commitment he made to kids to keep us off the streets and to keep us into something positive. And Jay, I don't know if he really knew it at the time, but he sort of bridged the gap between one part of the Hill and the other part of the Hill. So I was playing with dudes from Church Street South. And, you know, normally I'm playing against them, but with the Hill All-Stars, it was truly sort of a Hill All-Star team. And so I really appreciate that. A little later on, I had a chance to play for Mr. A for years for him. It was great getting to know him both as a person and as a coach as well. So look, I am the Hill. I could talk about the Hill all day. I know we can't, but I love the Hill, man. We're Hill Central, Roberto Clemente, Lee High School, Hill All-Stars, Mr. A, Boys and Girls Club. All my friends lived in the Hill. Everything I needed was here in the Hill, man. So that's one of my fondest memories of the time.
Wow. I mean, we continue talking about the Hill.
Yeah.
Let's go through your resume, your academic resume a little bit. What kind of schools you went? Where do you go to college?
Yeah, so it was interesting. I didn't even know if I was going to go to college. I had what I considered at the time in 1982, 83, a good job at Yale New Haven Hospital, right, part-time. So my senior year, I got this part-time job. And in the 80s, I was making more than $6 an hour. So I was, you know, I didn't have any financial responsibility. I wasn't paying rent or mortgage. So I was just, I had it. And I thought maybe I would work at Yale for any number of years and then retire from Yale. But then I was on a city bus, just going to a friend's house, and it went by Southern. And it was my senior year. And I said, I think I got to figure out what I'm going to do with my life. And so I said, you know what? Southern's right here in New Haven. There's probably a lot of Black people there, probably about a lot of Latinos, probably people I know. Let me try this. So I got off the bus, and instead of going to a friend's house, went to the admissions office at Southern and said, where do I sign up? And Dr. Williams, who was, I think, associate admissions director at the time, saw me looking kind of lost and said, let me give you some help. And he helped me and he pointed me in the right direction. So I said, you know what? I'm going to try this. I'm going to try college. And at that time, you could afford to pay. I could afford to pay for Southern. It was only like $500 a semester. Yeah, because I didn't live on campus. So I could pay $500 a semester, right? Because I was working. And so I did that. And once I went, I was like, I think I like this. You know, nobody really said to me, go to college. That's how you move forward. You go to college, you get an education. Because I already had what I thought was a decent job. And probably could have been content with that. But just, I think it's that one decision to just get off the bus and walk into the admissions office, I think changed the course of my life. So
choices that we make.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
You see youngsters making choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I talk to them, I try to get them to understand that sort of that one choice you make at that moment could have an impact on the rest of your life because it sort of ripples throughout the rest of your life. And some make the wrong choices and some make sort of the right choices. So I went to Southern and finished undergraduate at Southern. And then I went back and got my master. I got my undergraduate degree in American history, and everybody was asking me what I was going to do with it. I said, well, some people go to college because they like to learn stuff. I mean, even in school when I was younger, I liked politics. I liked history. So I went to Southern and did that and got an undergraduate degree in history and went back, got certified, got a master's and got certified to teach social studies. So I did that. And I taught at Troop for a while and left there, went back and got my administrative certificate and became an assistant principal at East Rock on the middle school side. Left there and sort of 2 or 3 days before school started 1 year, the superintendent at the time, Reggie Mayo, called me on the weekend before school was going to start and said, we're going to move you, make you principal of Beecher Elementary School. Now, I didn't have any elementary experience at all. I went to elementary school. But other than that, I didn't work in one. That was all. I had all secondary experience. So that job just sort of came to me, and I had to learn on the fly how to do this, how to be a principal, and then how to do elementary school. And so that worked well. I was there for about 4 years, and then I became principal of Hamden High School in 2006. And I didn't go looking for that job. I was just at work one day and got contacted by some folks in Hamden who said, we got a few jobs open. You interested in any of them? Here's what they are. And I said, well, I never had done high school. So I was principal of Beecher, and Beecher probably at the time had about 325, 330 kids. Hamden High School, when I got there, had 2,300 kids all in one building, high school, in a town that I, you know how it was with Hamden at the time. I mean, I didn't want to be caught at night in Hamden. I wanted to get out of Hamden as quick as I could get out of Hamden when I was much younger. So it wasn't necessarily seen as a place that was open to people of color at the time. And so I became the first African-American principal of that high school. And I had a great time. And a lot of the students I had at that point, I still am in contact with today. Still see them. They've got families of their own and kids of their own. And they make me feel a little old sometimes. But it's always good to know that they're doing very well. Then I moved from that position to human resource position in central office, because I was principal of Hamden High for about 9 years and said that that was enough for me. I didn't even believe I was going to stay that long, to be frank with you, but I loved it so much. The kids were so good. The parents were so supportive. It was a great staff. And so I didn't have a reason to leave. I could have just settled in and stayed there forever, but I kept pushing myself to do something different. So I did HR, and then I became an assistant superintendent for human resources. And then now superintendent of my second year superintendent, Hamden Public Schools, and first African-American superintendent in that school district's history. So that's where we are.
I'm going to touch on a few things. First is being in a position, being in a position to accept that those offers. How important is that?
Yeah, you have to be, you just have to keep pushing yourself to be a little bit better every day, to do a little bit more every day. And if there's something you want in life, you have to dedicate your time and prepare for it, right? Because there are any number of people who may have the credentials and any number of people who may have the desire to do things. But it's really the preparation, because I had taught, I was an assistant principal. I was an elementary school principal. I was a high school principal. I did HR. All that was in preparation to be where I am right now, but I saw it. I knew what I had to do before I got the position. I wasn't looking for a shortcut. I wasn't looking for a handout. I was just looking for a fair opportunity to be in the position, because I know what I could give to kids, and I know the sort of commitment I would make to them, and I would really make it about them and not about me and not about any adult at all, but really just about the students who were there. But it took a lot of work, and it took a lot of grinding and a lot of hustling and a lot of seeing other people who, let me just put this the right way, seeing people who I knew that I could do the job better than them in other places, get those positions. That didn't do anything to me. It didn't deter me. It didn't change my path. I knew what I had to do. Because I think if you're going to serve people, you ought to be the best servant that you can be. And that requires preparation. It requires sacrifice. It requires a lot of things. So while I saw others get to places faster, I didn't see them sort of prepare with the depth that I think I was prepared. So this job is sort of 30 years in the making. Right. And just being able to say, just do all the work, just do all the work. And when the opportunity comes, you'll meet the opportunity. You'll rise to the occasion. You'll meet that opportunity. And I was fortunate enough to get an opportunity in Hamden. So
there are children right now in our neighborhoods and in the Hill making these bad decisions.
Yeah.
Can you just say something about it, to attest to the fact that maybe it's never too late?
Yeah, it really never is too late to for a person to change the course of their own life. And, I heard this on the radio decades ago, and it stuck with me. And it was an advertisement for something, but I can't remember. And it said, if you can't find a role model, then be one. And that really stuck with me like forever, Like, if you can't find a role model and be one, I was fortunate enough to be exposed to role models in my community and in my neighborhood. So, but the kids who feel that they can't make it, I would just say this to them. And this is just not somebody who's talking from this position. I mean, when I was 13, I didn't have contact with my father at all. And my mother had passed away. She wasn't there either. And so it was a very difficult situation for me. I had a brother who has spent a lot of time in jail, probably most of his life in jail. So if I wanted to go down a path of, you know, if I wanted to be a gangster in the 80s, could have been a gangster in the 80s. I mean, and I had friends who chose that. But the one thing I think that was important for me was that I didn't let my friends choose me. I chose my friends. And because I didn't let them choose me, I chose them. I knew what kind of people I wanted to hang out with and who I wanted to be around. Because for the most part, that's what it boils down to today for young people. Like, who do you want to be around? Like, who are you around? What are you doing? What kind of people are you with? Because that tells me a whole lot. So students trying to make decisions nowadays, because of my upbringing, you know, I don't tolerate excuses. But I am at the same time empathetic, because everybody has their own story and you have to understand and respect that story. And kids, their brains just are not developed. So they make a lot of bad decisions one after the other. A lot of times they don't learn from their mistake once or twice or three times. But with kids, you just have to stick with them. You know, it's easy to say this kid's not going to be anything, that kid's not going to be anything. I don't recall during my whole school experience, anybody either saying to me or leading me to believe that I wasn't going to be anything. Not once. And I know a lot of people have stories about a teacher who might have said something to them, but I never had that experience. I think I grew up at a time where adults genuinely cared about kids. And I felt that they cared about me, even if they didn't really know me. I felt that they were there for me and they understood sort of everything that I was going through. But with kids today, they're just different. You hear it all the time. You might even believe it all the time. Like, these kids are just not as tough as we used to be, right? Like, I used to be able to put my mouth on a spigot in the back of my house and drink water out of it. Now you're drinking water out of bottles. But so there's some changes that have happened over time. And, you know, you get a concern about whether parents are bubble wrapping their kids and don't want them to fail. You know how many times we failed? Like, you know how many times I try to learn how to ride a bike and kept falling down? There was nobody on the side of me trying to hold me up. Nobody making sure I had a helmet on. You should wear a helmet, kids, if you're out there riding a bike. But if you're out there and you have to learn things on your own and you have to make good decisions within the context of learning these things on your own, they're just some things you learn, man. Like, the adversity you face makes you a different kind of person. Either it can make you or it can break you. Right? Nowadays, I see it breaking a lot of people. But back in the day, you didn't have that. Like, that wasn't even an option. You were, like, in the 80s, 70s, 80s, even up to the 90s, I think. Like, you weren't going to be broken by any of that. You had an obstacle. You're like, damn, that's just, that didn't work. What am I going to do? I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. You didn't give up. You didn't crumble. You didn't fold like a cheap suit. You just kept working at it. And the one thing that I do see that concerns me is that I think not just students, but in general, people have a hard time persevering through adversity. And that perseverance through adversity, if you're a hill person, you had to persevere because you were going to face adversity in the hill, whether it was personal, whether it was family, whether it was school. But you were going to face it, and you were going to face it more than once and in more than one way. But being able to push through because you didn't think you had an option was what happened for many of us, probably yourself included.
Product of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. This is The Electric Drum. I'm Jose Candelario, and we're speaking with Gary Highsmith, Superintendent of Schools, Hamden. Perseverance, What there are a lot of changes, and what changes have you seen in your students over time, outside of perseverance and their ability to cope with challenges?
Well, when we were younger, there was only one telephone in our house, right? And if you're a kid in the house, you're a low person on a totem pole. Like, you probably are the lowest. Your older siblings had a right to be on the phone more than you did. Obviously, your parents took precedent in the house. And so what we had to do was see each other to communicate. We had to be with each other. So we spent a lot of time together outside, being creative, figuring out what we're going to do, you know, taking a stick and a tire and playing with a stick and a tire for 3 hours and not even realizing that 3 hours passed, right? Taking initiative, shoveling people's snow, raking their leaves, carrying their groceries home for them just to make a buck. But we were sort of animals out in the wild, right? Just figuring out our way. Nowadays, you got a bunch of domesticated animals like cats in the house, and students would rather be in the house than be outside. And then I know there's some neighborhoods where safety is a concern, but if you remove that, they still aren't spending much time outside of the house. And that interaction where you hang with somebody, you talk to them, they become your friend, you do things together, you form a friendship based on things that were real. Like real, like, I don't know about you, but a lot of the friends I had as friends in the Hill when I was growing up are still my best friends to this day, because you made that connection and you went through all of that with them and you like these people. Nowadays, there's too many opportunities for kids to communicate with each other. They stay connected to each other all the time, but they're not forming bonds with each other and friendship with each other. They're just communicating with each other and they're talking about other people and they're feeling badly about themselves. And they're constantly, constantly, constantly on the search to be liked and for approval and to fit in. And, you know, I'm fortunate that we grew up in an era where you can be as different as you want. And I don't even recall people putting any negative thing on that difference. It was just like, you're a little different, you know, and just keep it moving. But then this whole cookie cutter sort of thing happened where everybody wanted to be like everybody. And what was different, what was unique about people had to be pushed aside. My hope is that we can respect the differences in people. We can respect that there isn't one type of person, that there are many types of people, all with the same level of importance, who deserve the same level of respect. But if there's one difference, man, it's just this constant communication, not letting go, constantly checking social media, constantly trying to find out what's going on. We didn't have to do that because we were in it. We were making things happen. We were engaged with each other. We were talking to each other. We were on the same teams. I was over your house. You were over my house. So we lived our whole lives, a lot of us, in one area and never had to go out of that area for anything. You had school. You had boys club, you had stores, you had everything, every single thing you wanted. You never had to leave your neighborhood. I don't even recall taking a bus to school for years. I'm walking to school. I walked to Hill Central. I walked to Lee. I walked to Clemente. And then walking to school, that act in and of itself helped me create stronger bonds with my friends because we're all walking at the same time. So we're seeing each other before school. We're seeing each other all day during school. We see each other after school. We continue to have those bonds and they got stronger and stronger over time. And my concern is that when you have a town or a city with a lot of different schools and a lot of choices for people to go to, those connections disappear. And so you are creating friendships, but then you don't see them after school anymore. You're not hanging with them anymore. You're not playing on the same teams with them anymore. So that connection is just during school. So we miss sort of that deeper connection. So I think that's a thing that concerns me. And how do we find a way and how do we teach kids how to form relationships and what a relationship based on respect and trust and friendship really looks like?
You are from this area. Mm-hmm. You grew up with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
How important are parents as advocates for their children, and they're your peers as well. How is it? How do you go about educating them as well?
Yeah, I think we've gone from a time when my mother, up until the time I was 13, she was alive. I don't know how often my mother went to the school. I don't know how often my mother called the principal's office. I just one time I can remember my mother having to come to the school for anything to do with me. And that's because I think I was in the fifth grade at Horace Day, and I was in a classroom, and they were only speaking Spanish in a classroom. And I didn't understand anything. So I went the first day, and I'm like, okay, we'll figure this out. And then I went home, and I didn't see any of my friends in the classroom the second day or the third day or the fourth day. I went home, and I told my mother, I said, I think I'm in the wrong class. And she said, no, don't worry about it. You'll be fine. You don't need your friends in your class. They'll be your friends after school. I'm like, no, there's something up here. And so I think I was put in a bilingual class by mistake. Remember, there's no computers at those times. People write stuff down by hand. Who knows what happened? And then I got in a different class because I just was not. I wish I had understood Spanish much better, but I did not understand Spanish at all. So my mother really wasn't in school a lot. My mother would never write a letter to the superintendent of schools or call a superintendent of schools. At that point, parents said, go to school, don't get any trouble, and don't have anybody call my house about you because it's going to be a problem for you, because I believe them when they call me. Right. They had some reverence in the community. Then over time, that all changed and people stopped trusting and believing educators the way they used to. And instead of sort of being allies, there are situations where there's such a lack of trust. And sometimes that's legitimate. Right. So there's some school experiences. I mean, you parents who themselves had bad school experiences have thinking about school that requires us as a school system to work harder to gain your trust. I think one of the things I've seen over time is that respect for teaching and for teachers and administrators and principals and so forth, I think that's eroded. And I think instead of believing and trusting in us, we're being doubted and questioned and not believed. And so it's a more of an adversarial relationship at this point than it was sort of a collaborative relationship. And so if we could find a way to turn that around, and one of the best ways to do it, I think, is to just be honest with parents, right? If the school system isn't working the way that it should, acknowledge that, right? If we did something wrong, acknowledge it and say, you know what? Shouldn't have done it that way. I mean, I remember one instance when I was principal of the high school, and we were concerned about how girls were dressing when they came to our dance, right? And so we were really adamant about that. Like, look, you can't dress that way. This is the way. You got to respect yourself. And that all sounded good on its face until a few parents had a concern about it and said, look, to us, my daughter should be able to dress. She wants to dress. And not be worried about what boys are going to say. Shouldn't your focus be on getting the boys to be respectful as opposed to getting the girls to be compliant? And so I listened to these parents. I met with them in person. And by the time I finished talking to them, my perspective on things changed. And I went on a PA afterwards and apologized to students who we had sent home because we felt that their skirts were too short. And it was a learning experience for me as an administrator. I mean, in those instances, you say, you know what? I ain't think about it like that. So now that you brought that to my attention, let's process that. Because sometimes schools are wrong. Sometimes administrators are wrong. Sometimes there are things that happen that are based on race or gender or based on whether a person is gay or straight. I mean, that happens, right? We're all humans. It's not like administrators are not human. We are human. We have our political beliefs. We have our religious beliefs. We have our educational beliefs. We have our beliefs based on our own experiences, just growing up and being in our own families. And sometimes we don't get it right. But any system that's unwilling to say we didn't get it right deserves to have agitation. But if you are a system who can listen to parents, hear their perspective, and you don't have to agree every time, but you at least have to respect them to the degree that you want them to respect you. So I don't go into a situation believing I know everything, but I do enter situations believing that is an opportunity for me to learn. And so let me try and learn first and understand before I decide. But there are some of us who go in already decided. And no matter what they say to us, here's what the decision is. I think we just have to be more open-minded, and parents have to be more trusting that we're not out to get your kids. We want to hold them accountable, and let us hold them accountable, right? I think one of the things I've seen often is we try to hold students accountable, parents, some parents, and their attempt to form better relationships with their kids will support them even when they're wrong. And so if we both just say we're wrong when we're wrong, and then try to move forward with that, I think things will be better for us.
You have gone through a demographic change in Hamden over the years, cultural change. How can how have you adjusted in your approach to help the community along with that?
Yeah, I was. That's a very good question, because I happened to be at the high school through all that demographic change, and it was very challenging, because when I walked into the position, I'm not even going to go into specifics, but there were more than a few people who weren't happy that I was there for any number of reasons. I didn't have any prior high school experience. I didn't come from Hamden. Hamden is like a lot of other towns where they like for you to be from that area, as if you can't come from someplace else and understand the area. There was some stuff, race-based stuff, people would say and do. But they had the right one in place, because it took a little bit more than people saying things that were racist or writing things that were racist to run me out. But seeing that shift and seeing the need to make sure that, you know, we want to make sure that the curriculum is more inclusive and reflects the many cultures that are there. We wanted to make sure that since the staff is a mostly white staff, right, predominantly white staff, doesn't mean that they can't understand children of color. It means that they might need some help in better understanding them. But, you know, I had white teachers who loved me, I believe, like they love their own children. So I'm not going to say because a person is white, they don't understand kids of color. That would be as ridiculous as saying a teacher who is Latino doesn't understand white students. I've never even heard anybody say that before, right? Because on its face, it's not right. But there are instances where there are a number of teachers and administrators who had a different cultural experience growing up, because Connecticut is such a segregated state that most white people are going to grow up around other white people. Most black people are going to grow up, and Latinos are going to grow up around black and Latino. Now that's changing even. The demographics are even changing in that instance. But in order to make sure that people understand, like if I got a job, just I don't desire this, I'm just make clear about it. But if I got a job in a really suburban town, like high socioeconomics, and I happen to get a job there, for the record, I don't envision myself applying for a job like that. But if I did, I'd have a lot of cultural learning, because that's not my experience. Right. There'll be so many things I would have to learn but I would walk in there knowing I would have to learn that. The question is, when it's the reverse and people walk into a situation where there are mostly students of color, do they believe they have to learn? One of the problems I think we've had in this country for a long time is that black and Latino voices and other Asian and other voices of color have been locked out. So it would be easy for any number of white people to just say, I've got nothing to learn from them. They've got everything to learn from me. It was America. They should learn how to be American, right? But the flip, you have to flip that on its head and enter any situation as if it's an opportunity to learn for you. And if we can get everybody to understand, and I don't want to assume that every Latino or every African-American understands Latino and African-American kids, particularly important if you're in public service to a group that you learn about that group, that you'll be willing to listen to that group, that you understand. I mean, even it, for us, it comes so naturally. Like when I taught at Troop, it was almost all, if not all, Black and Latino students at Troop at the time. So one of my goals was to get them to understand how important it is to code switch, right? To be able to talk different languages to different people, but maintain a sense of who you are throughout that. And so I worked on it and worked on it and worked. In the beginning, they didn't quite get it. It's like, this is who I am. It's like, why are you trying to change me? I'm like, I'm not trying to change you. I'm trying to improve you. So, and I said, there's a difference because you can change without improvement. So let's talk about how we improve your communication when you're dealing with people. And over time, we were able to do that. But I valued the language they bought into the building. So because I understood it, we were talking the same language after school was over. We were all talking the same language. I could understand it. I knew what they were trying to say. So I helped them say it in more than one way. Never told them the way they were saying it was wrong. But I also said, there's an additional way to say that in these sorts of settings. So there's a way you talk to adults, the way you talk to your parents, the way you talk to your friends, the way you talk to your teachers, and all these people are different. And here's how you talk to all of them and get the same point across the way you need to get it across. So because I came from a culture that values other cultures, I was able to work with them. If I walked in and come from a culture that says, I'm just here to teach you, I'm not here to learn from you, I'm not here to get you to understand, I just want you to understand me, I don't have any obligation to understand you, that's problematic. I think that happens across the country, probably happens across the world. But the minute we open ourselves up to being better listeners and better learners, the kids will come around. But and the kids know if you're real or not. Like the first 5 seconds they talk to you, they know it right off the rip if you're real or not. And if you just are real with them, because one of my favorite teachers was Dr. Bert Saxon. He was at Lee High School, taught me my freshman year. And Dr. Saxon was sort of, he'll tell you himself, like the corniest of white dudes you could ever meet. But he became my favorite teacher because he valued what I said. And he pushed me, and he was empathetic, but he didn't feel sorry for me. And I think we run into instances where there's some kids who have such difficult conditions that adults who are working with them feel a sense of sorrow instead of a sense of empathy. Mm. And see empathy and high standards as an opposition to each other. You could be empathetic, but still hold people to high standards. Like, yeah, I understand you got it tough at home, but I need my homework tomorrow. Mm. And I need my homework for these reasons. I'm not letting you off the hook, because I can continue to let you off the hook, and that's not going to help you in the long run. And fortunately, I think if you ask my former students, we liked each other. But I told them when I first met them, I would rather be respected by you than liked by you. And because I don't want to be that teacher who years later you realize they didn't do anything for you, but you liked them because they were cool. So those things, I've seen those things happen over time. And, you know, you just have to approach the situation as a willing learner, as opposed to an instructor.
You have to be a super learner because you get it from mm-hmm. both ends. Mm-hmm. You have employees mm-hmm. yeah. and you have the public and the parents. Mm-hmm. How what virtues get you through the day?
Just keeping it real with them, right? Just keeping it real with them and not being afraid. I think, and it doesn't mean I don't have fear, but I'm not afraid because the way I'm dealing with this matter, I truly believe is in the best interest of the kids that I'm serving, right? So I'm not making political decisions about kids' lives. I'm not playing politics with adults' lives. I'm not doing any of that. I'm just trying to make the best sort of educational decisions that I could make to help every student have a world-class learning experience. That's it. Like, what's the best thing that we can do to make the best school system for all these kids. And that's my goal. I don't have another goal. I don't have an agenda. I'm not promoting myself. I'm not out there trying to get the next job. I'm not, it's not anything I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to do what's right. So being able to balance all of those during the time when social media is becoming increasingly more important. And that's a challenge because things happen. If somebody texts their parents post, that could be 30 seconds that all happens. And before you can even get a word out to the rest of the community, it's out there. It's posted on this site. It's posted on that. It's posted on X. It's posted on Twitter. It's posted on the gram. And you haven't even had a chance to respond. And in many cases, you may not even know what happened. And it's like, wait a minute, what happened? Or somebody will call and say, I saw something on Instagram, or I saw something on Facebook. It's usually Facebook because it's older people are on Facebook and don't hesitate to post stuff because, you know, what social media has done is turn everybody into a media mogul or a reporter who thinks they have breaking news every time something happened. Now, more than half of the time, they're dead wrong. They don't have all the facts. They don't know all the facts. But once you put it out there, it's out there. So you lose almost every time in a race against time in order to get the truth out. So all you got to do is be deliberate, be thoughtful, be thorough, and just tell people what actually happened. And I mean, that's the biggest challenge. You ask any superintendent, it's like things just go right out. And now you're hearing from board members, well, oh my God, I heard X, Y, and Z. And my point is always give us a chance to look into it. That may or may not be true. You may have 10% of the truth. You may have 100%, but we don't know that because we're just finding out about it the same way that you are. So it's social media that has changed the game. Not always for the better either.
What changes do you wish to instill during your time here, or what positive things that you think you could bring about?
One of the things I want to do is to make sure that we have equity across the school system, that whenever there is segregation, even within the building or within the classroom, that we disrupt that segregation so that everybody has an equal opportunity to succeed in schools, that we have a school system that just is coherent across the district and it just makes sense, that we don't start things and stop things, that we don't try something, you know, that's difficult, get pushback, and then go, okay, five people didn't like it, so I'm not going to do it. You just got to, if you believe in a thing, you got to continue to push forward with it. So I wanted to change the school start times. That may not seem like much to most people outside of education, but trying to change school start times to get everybody on the same start time at elementary, in particular, because we had two different tiers for elementary. Fourth school started at this time. Fourth school started at a different time. And that was just a mess, I thought, because it was built in efficiency and transportation. So I said, well, let's change that. And boom, off into fireworks. But we stayed with it and we had good reasons and we worked with the bus company and we talked to parents and we got feedback and did all the work we were supposed to do over the course of a year last year and took our time and explained things to people why we were doing them. And there was pushback, but it wasn't to the degree I think that most people anticipated, because we kept explaining as we went along, this is why we want to do what we want to do. And we were able to do that. And I think that's a significant accomplishment for us, because now it makes it, everybody's there at the same time. You create better efficiency with the buses, but you also give teachers more time together, because you had half the elementary teachers who could go to a meeting at this time, half that go a half hour into the meeting. So people run in the meeting, have to try and start the meeting over. It was a mess. So now I think we've got sort of the transportation system that we're looking for, the school start time that we're looking for. So I think you have to find out what makes good sense. And it's not sort of the sexy things that you see in a newspaper. Splash, here's $100 million grant from this place in order to do X, Y, and Z. But then you look 3 or 4 years later and nothing's happened. Like, things are not better with the $100 million grant, but you took the time, you looked at the organization, You made it better aligned. You made things make sense. And now kids are learning better. But nobody hears about that in a newspaper. It's just work that happens behind the scenes. And that's the real work. That's the work that I prefer to do. Not the splashy work that gets you headlines, but the hard work where you're up day and night, sort of working at it. And then bang, you've got that system aligned the way you want to. So that's the work.
Well, thank you for your time, Mr. Highsmith.
My pleasure.
Now, this is the Electric Drum, you know, 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. And thank you for Mr. Gary Highsmith, the superintendent for the town of Hendon Schools, doing the best he can for his kids. And very proud to say, product of the hill.
That's right, baby.
From the hood to good.
That's right.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.